I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. New immigrants are changing America's cities in many ways, but what's happening in immigrant neighborhoods is not always easily understood. Vicky Katz and Sandra Ball Rokish, both at the University of Southern California, are working in the immigrant neighborhoods of Los Angeles to learn how communication flows and what that means to mainstream media and political leaders. They'll tell us what they found out today on Smart City. Todd Hoffman, president of Collegia, is also with us. Collegia works with colleges and communities to attract and retain top student talent. That's all today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Todd Hoffman is president and founder of Collegia, a company that focuses on connecting colleges and communities. Todd, writing for CEOs for Cities, Harvard professor and strategist Michael Porter did a study about 6 years ago that looked at the relationship between colleges and their communities. Collegia is working on connecting colleges and communities in a variety of ways. Describe your work.
Well, we get involved in various communities, Philadelphia, Boston, Pittsburgh, where they've recognized that keeping more of their college students will have a tremendous impact on the sort of size and quality of their workforce.
And so how do you help them keep their college graduates?
Well, there's actually a three-stage measure, which starts when they're only in high school, where we have programs that try to attract more students to a region by selling the qualities of those regions and the resources that are there. Once they enroll, we try to get them off campus as often as possible to become integrated and connected with the communities. And then if we've done our homework right and the students are connected and have developed an affinity, then when they're connected with internships, that affinity plus the internship will increase their likelihood of sticking around when they graduate.
Let's dig in on a couple of those things. Selling the quality of the community, how do you do that?
First, by talking to students who are already there. In every community we've been to, college seniors have a far greater appreciation for the region than college freshmen. They've been around, they have cars, they know where to go. There's always something there that the younger students don't know about. So if we can introduce them to those resources earlier, that helps. And so that takes care of what already exists. The bigger part is to try to get community leaders, be they employers, mayors, civic leaders, what have you, to sit around the same table with the college presidents and devise programs that will open up the community to the students who are at whatever campus is in the region.
And give me a couple of examples from your work, say, in Boston or in Pittsburgh.
Well, in Boston, we're now starting a program aimed at, on one level, increasing Boston's appeal to students of color. It's one of the issues that every campus in the area faces, and to face it alone is very difficult, but to do it together and collaboratively, I think we can make huge inroads. There's also the aspect of making Boston better for minority students. So there are two parts there. One is a marketing exercise, and the other is community engagement.
Are you far enough along in the exploration there that you know what some of the tactics might be?
Oh, there are events. We have a mixer on one campus at the end of October. There's a portal that we're developing where just knowing where to go to find information will be of huge impact. Because right now, students on whatever campus, be it Tufts, Harvard, BU, BC, they know what's going on campus, but they don't really know what's going off campus. In the neighborhoods of Boston. And the neighborhoods of Boston are sort of rich with culture and texture and everything that, whether you're Latino or African American or American Indian, you can find comfort zones or you can find connections to your own heritage that are very important to making you feel welcome here.
What have college seniors told you that surprised you about these cities?
Well, jobs are paramount, of course. Issues are not just the job that they would get out of college, but the job after that. So I'd say they're very savvy shoppers. They have pretty much confirmed our notion and many people's notion that quality of life is more important now than ever. When we graduated college, we went to where the jobs were. Now when students graduate college, it's really the jobs are going, migrating to where the students want to be. So they seem to be have the upper hand in most places.
But when you sit down with college seniors in, say, Boston,
mm-hmm.
what have they said to you? What have they told you about the city and what they've discovered about the city, what they've discovered they like about the city that you then may want to share with a college freshman? I'm just looking for a couple of examples.
Oh, well, there are two ways to go with that. One is many are quite often disappointed. They thought they'd get off campus more often, and it just never happened. So there was a missed opportunity where if it was easier and it was more encouraged, they would have had more time in the city. They would have left Somerville or Medford and Tufts campus and gone into the city and maybe done some community service or gone to the clubs or any measure of city activities, and they didn't. Others will tell us that just a single impact with a local resident can be a make or break, where that can sort of break the ice. If they're coming from Wisconsin and they've had a nice connection, either through a professor or through some, you know, community service with the city, then that paints a very, very different picture than the one they have when they're back on campus.
You said getting connected is part of your three-step strategy to keeping more college graduates in a city. Tell me about the programs you use to get college graduates or college students connected to their communities.
I guess the most advanced model we have is Philadelphia under the umbrella of the Knowledge Industry Partnership. And there, the head of tourism, the mayor, the head of economic development, several other leaders have been collaborating for 3 years now with this sort of three-stage discrete approach where at the beginning we, you know, have drafted a whole messaging platform to market the Philadelphia as, quote-unquote, one big campus so that students will recognize that when they come to Philadelphia, regardless of what school they go to, they have access to the other campuses, but also to tremendous opportunities off campus. So there's a magazine, there's a website, there are hotel discounts. Anything we can do to make it easier for that prospect and parent to actually sample both the campus and the city. So that's one whole, there's a team effort right there. Once they arrive, right at the beginning of their freshman year, there's a big party called the Kickoff. We've had up to 30,000 students comes to a downtown concert in late September. All of the museums around Benjamin Franklin Parkway are open for students that day. They're introduced to the transportation system, to the museums, to employers, to really the fabric of Philadelphia so that they know that they're supposed to be connected with it. And it's easy to connect to it for the next 2 to 4 years. And we also introduced at that point our Camp Career Philly program, which has done a tremendous job of both generating internships and promoting the internships that exist to students through internship fairs and other activities, which is sort of that final, that's the final 10 yards. But as we've seen, whether it's Philadelphia or somewhere else, if they simply offer an internship and a student does an internship, it truly makes them more marketable. But if they're not connected emotionally to the city, it really works as a get-out-of-jail-free card, and it makes it easier for even the locally grown talent to leave. So they, we've really discovered how important it is to plant the seeds, to have them connected during that early social, personal aspect of their college career, so that when they're starting to become professionally focused, one slips right into the other, and by the time they're senior, they really are giving Philadelphia a shot or Cleveland and Akron or what have you. And that's very much driven by the involvement of a whole host of off-campus partners who recognize that it's in their own best interest to reach out to students.
You've been working there for 3 years in Philadelphia. What have been the results?
At the front end, admissions and enrollments up 10%. It's higher than the rest of the state, and it's higher than the national average. That's over about 4 years, from 2002 to 2005. And we poll students every year. 65% of students now want to stay in Philadelphia when they graduate. That's 2005. The number in 2002 was 50%. same question, same survey instrument, you know, same set of students, but a very different result. So we do feel like our front-end work has helped. In the last measure of whether or not they're staying, we do have a net increase, but we haven't seen a growth rate in the actual retention rate. And part of that is that whole chicken or the egg. We do need more jobs. We do need a better impression among students that those jobs will lead to other better jobs and that Philadelphia is the place to be, not just for the foot soldiers out there who are graduating, but also the best and brightest who are going to create the next wave of jobs.
What's been the conversation in Philadelphia around that topic? That's a tough one.
People are coming together. We think that it's not just chicken or the egg, it's both. That there are, you know, select Philadelphia and other groups are working on matters related to job creation. And they recognize that the Knowledge Industry Partnership is really the region's talent strategy. And it helps because when Select is out there promoting Philadelphia to potential businesses that either could grow or relocate, they're able to leverage the work that we do and say that there's a whole organization that's out there to make sure that the talent you're looking for, be it software engineers or, you know, scientists or what have you, that there will be talent readily available, not just for now, but when you grow.
Your firm, Collegia, is creating a new college destinations index. Tell me what you're measuring.
Well, we're trying to make a new statement that there's a new education equation out there, that it's not just choosing the academic offerings of a specific campus, but that it's a measure of three components that the student and the parent should be looking at. One is the academic environment or the academic selection. Two is the location and what the location will do to enhance that student's personal maturity. And then third is when it comes to professional preparation. If they do want to stay, great. Will there be a job there when they get out? Will there be a good salary, et cetera? Is it an entrepreneurial environment? But even if they're not looking to stay in the region, will there be internships at great rising star employers, be they in software or biotech or entertainment or what have you? So we've basically broken down 12 measures in three categories. Academic environment is one category. Quality of life is another category. And then professional opportunities. And when you bring those all together, this isn't about what kind of impact the colleges have on the community. It really is aimed at whether one city, Boston or Houston or L.A., is better than another city as a place to be a college student.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Todd Hoffman. He is president of Collegia. Let's talk about those three pieces, those three components and your 12 measures. Give me an idea of the measures you're using, say, for academic environment.
One is the level of student concentration. And that's both a measure of number of different institutions as well as what percentage of the local population are enrolled in a college. Another metric right there is percentage of students that are from other countries, because that exposure to the sort of global universe is critical nowadays. So on the academic environment end, R&D, international exposure, student concentration, and degree attainment. Are you in an environment where the general population is highly educated? So that's how we have boiled down our metrics for academic environment.
And quality of life?
Quality of life is access to cultural offerings, really. And there's a number of cultural offerings, be it entertainment, music, theater, arts, what have you, per population. And that's an index that we get through the census. Ease of travel, you know, the public transportation, access to that. We've used a measure of what percentage of population commutes by foot or bicycle or what have you, just to try to get a sense of how active the city and the region is in those terms. Creative strength, there are two measures that we draw from the Richard Florida folks in Catalytics. One is really the percent of the workforce that is engaged in the creative industry, and we put that under quality of life so that it becomes a measure of just how thick and active the sort of creative industries are in the, those regions. And then the other is very practical, affordability. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quality of life. Professional opportunities, we turn to Catalytics, but we also turn to the National Policy Institute, and they have an entrepreneurship index. We look at earnings potential, sort of average salary. We look at unemployment rate. Put those together, and that gives us a sense of how one environment is shaping up versus another. To give you an example, under quality of life in our mid-sized metros, Providence comes in number 3. They do very, very well. They also do pretty well under professional opportunities. They don't do as well when we look at our academic environment, though I think that's rising for a city like Providence. Our 1, 2, and 3 are Palo Alto, Raleigh, Durham, and Denver within that mid-tier.
Isn't it true, though, Todd, that first of all, the university you attend confers a certain status on you, either high status, low status? I'm curious, did you take any of that into account as you prepared your index?
We did. We would like to take the emphasis off the brand name of any specific school, though that's important, especially in cocktail conversation. Interestingly enough, earlier in the week, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal titled "Any College Will Do." And it basically said, when you look at the chief executives of the Fortune 500, they're more likely to get there if they went to a state university than if they went to the Ivy Leagues.
And what that suggests to me is something rather different. I saw the same article, and it suggests that if I go to school close to home, am employed close to home, then I get in because I'm close to home, I rise because of my talent. I'm wondering how that informs or runs contrary to, perhaps, your notion of professional opportunities.
Oh, we think it plays right into it. As we've seen at Temple in Philadelphia or University of Akron, those students are very engaged locally because they grew up there. So they already get it that it isn't all about the brand name on the degree, that it's about access to community internship, politics. You know, right from their freshman year, I've witnessed it at these kind of schools. They remain civically focused as much as they are students.
You've put your index together. When you step back from it, Todd, what's the real insight that you take away from the index?
I guess we walked away with this sense of, what does it take to create a leader? Who's going to create the next economy? It's leaders. And when you're looking to help somebody move from a learner to leader, it isn't going to happen in the classroom. That's a part of it, but it's, you know, I think it confirmed our notion that too many people use U.S. News and World Report and some of the other indexes when they're shopping for a college. They don't shop correctly, and they're not getting the right advice. And to go from learner to leader, you really need to push that, you know, surely academic achievement, but personal maturity is required as well as professional experience. And when you put it all together, then when you take that 22-year-old, those are the ones you want to hire. And those are the ones who will advance further. And sort of they'll recognize their role as citizens in their local economy, not just workers.
Will the full index be online?
It will be online at collegia.com. We are not releasing it until later in November, but if anybody wants to look or email us, we can potentially give them a preview prior. Keep your computer pointed to www.collegia.com, and hopefully there'll be a media pickup and people will become aware of it that way as well.
Todd, thanks for being our guest on Smart City. Todd Hoffman is president and founder of Collegia. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Vicki Katz and Sandra Ball-Rokish about the immigrant Los Angeles few of us know. And we'll visit with Otis White about local taxes and how they drive land use. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, the analysis of local taxes seems never-ending. The question is always, is sales tax better? Is property tax better? Is payroll tax better? And that debate has been playing out in, of all places, Palo Alto in California.
Yeah. You know where Palo Alto is. It's south of San Francisco. It's, in many ways, a very, very lucky place. It is the next neighbor over to Stanford University. So obviously a lot of educated people, high property values and so on. It's a pretty lucky place, but it is doing something that on first glance just seems bizarre. Its local government is trying very hard to get car lots to locate in the city of Palo Alto, to the point of even setting aside some land along a busy Highway 101 to persuade them that that's the best place to put Carl's used cars and other auto dealerships. And when you think about it, car lots are not exactly a wonderful land use. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that most local governments are excited about. So you have to ask the question, well, why are they so dead set in Palo Alto on getting car lots to move there? And the answer is because the local governments in California and Palo Alto in particular have become so dependent on sales taxes. And when you think about car lots, the one thing you realize is that when you buy a car, you pay a lot in sales tax because it's such a high-value purchase. And so governments are doing all kinds of crazy things to get in these stores, car lots, and other things that generate a lot of sales tax. It's kind of a sad commentary on how skewed the local tax bases have become in these places, and unfortunately, that's just one of the byproducts of being so dependent on sales taxes.
Our good colleague Joe Courtright in Portland, Oregon, talks about the fact that Portland has no sales tax, and therefore its land use policy is not driven by the need for sales tax, therefore giving it a better land use policy. And I would agree with that. The unfortunate thing is that people drive over from Vancouver, Washington, who pay, of course, no taxes in Oregon to shop free of sales tax, and then, of course, go home to Washington. It's a dilemma when you try to work this out on a local level, and yet economies, of course, are not local. It becomes a very complex puzzle.
Well, I have long said that if you tell me what the tax base is composed of in a community, I'll tell you how that community will turn out. That is, if it's a community which depends greatly on sales taxes, you'll see a lot of retail. If it's a community that depends a great deal on property taxes, you'll see a lot of high-value uses like factories there. And if it depends on payroll taxes, you'll see a lot of offices there. So show me the tax base. I can pretty much predict how that town's going to turn out.
Well, there seems to be no perfect formula. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Vicki Katz and Sandra Ball-Rokish work at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communication on something called the Metamorphosis Project. It is a huge effort to study communication patterns in Los Angeles neighborhoods in all their variety and ethnic diversity. They are operating in at least six languages to find out what really goes on in the city's storytelling network. Vicki, when we think about a city with the kind of larger-than-life reputation Los Angeles has, we tend to see it as an undifferentiated whole, but you've been exploring Los Angeles in its many parts, specifically its ethnic and immigrant neighborhoods. Tell me about that Los Angeles.
But Sandra started the project in 98, which far predates my involvement in the project, so let her tell you how it came about.
Well, it started because I was sitting out on my patio in 1992 watching the fires during the urban unrest of that period and thinking, wow, we should be able to do something to try and understand what makes for a strong community in this very, very diverse global city of Los Angeles. That's when we started by talking to the residents and finding out all kinds of different ways to get information about their everyday lives.
Sandra, is it possible that you can have strong community, depending on how you define community and the size of it, and not have a strong
larger community? In other words, can strong, tightly knit pieces of a community work against cohesion in the larger community?
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that because we haven't been able to. Well, I do know kind of an answer to that. It's surely the case that ethnicity defines where people live, and therefore community tends to unfold within ethnicity or race. And that provides for boundaries that prevent or work against people being residents of Los Angeles, per se. On the other hand, when you ask people how proud they are to live in their neighborhoods and tell people where they live, and then you also ask them how proud they are to tell people that they live in Los Angeles, there's a very high correlation there. People that are proud of where they live are also proud to be residents of Los Angeles. So whatever that means, you know, to people, there does seem to be an identification with Los Angeles as well as an identification with their own particular residential community.
When you were sitting there in 1992 watching the city of Los Angeles burn, what was your impulse about what makes for strong community?
Well, I think that one of the things that's happened is that we've lost what we call our local storytellers or our community storytellers. So much of the media, you know, has moved away from talking about neighborhoods to talking about regions and home countries and the world. Like if you look at the Los Angeles Times, it systematically deleted its local neighborhood news coverage. And I think that that's been a very important part of why we find it difficult for people to build community. We really need media storytellers to help us do that.
Do you think that's simply a function of the size of cities today?
No, I don't think so, because cities tend to unfold in everyday life in smaller communities. We don't live our life in the large megalopolis. We live it where we most centrally experience our everyday lives, and that really is still in our residential communities.
Does it include, when you say our residential communities, does that include the daily commute, the place you go to work and from work?
Usually not. And you're right to point to the commute as a major obstacle to community. When we ask people of all different ethnicities and social classes what's the biggest constraint on their participation in their local community, they say work. And it could be because it's such a long commute. It could be because they have multiple jobs. And it could be the long hours of work. So work is not really supporting us in our efforts to be good citizens of where we live.
And my guess is that's not going to change. Do you think about that in your work and think we need to change work to make more time available for community, or do we in fact need to change the ways in which people have opportunities to engage in community that are more suited to, more reflective of life's reality today?
The latter. I think we need to figure out how to be creative in creating community in a globalizing world where everyone is working too hard.
Carol, just to add to that, part of that's also that old measurements of things like civic engagement and political participation don't always reflect maybe new and different ways that people are finding of engaging themselves in their communities. And that's why we've started asking questions that draw the boundaries a lot more widely. Things like recycling or volunteering or, you know, being involved in PTAs and these sorts of things can all be ways in which people engage their communities, but they don't fit into kind of our more traditional definitions of participation, such as voting and these sorts of things, but can definitely indicate, you know, signs of a vibrant sense of community involvement.
So are there any truly new ways of civic engagement that you've discovered that have emerged as a result of globalization, that have emerged as a response to everyone's too busy, or even emerged as a result of different ethnicities, different immigrant groups being in this country?
Well, what we've found in some of the areas that we've studied is perhaps not that the activities themselves are new, but that the ways that people are organizing themselves and rallying around certain causes and the groups that are engaging are groups that have been written off prior to these kinds of events. For example, people assume that new immigrants and people who aren't citizens don't engage in their communities, and Latinos in particular have been found in the literature that they don't politically engage in many ways. But we've found in some of the communities that we've studied that resources, and that usually go unstudied, can be very useful in creating engagement and mobilization around a particular cause. For example, LA Unified reneged on a promise to build new schools, five new schools in an area in southeast Los Angeles. And this group of parents came together, you know, immigrants that have been in the country for less than 10 years, rallied around this cause and connected with each other mainly through interpersonal networks, because there were so little in the way of resources in terms of local media and community organizations that it was resident networks that bore the brunt of the efforts for mobilization, and they managed to pressure LA Unified into backing up their promise, which was an enormous achievement for a group of new immigrant Latinos to have accomplished. So it may not be entirely new practices of civic engagement, but maybe that we're seeing them emerge in different communities and in different ways than we'd seen before.
In your parents' era, in my parents' era too, the primary burden for a lot of the participation fell on upper-middle-class women, white women. And so an awful lot of the volunteering and the development of PTA, but also many, many other volunteer type of organizations, was really around people who had the means to be able to do that. What we're finding is that people are finding ways to mobilize and to try and make their communities better without having all of those advantages. They don't have the time, but they do use their shared concern for the welfare of their children and for the quality of, like, environmental justice types of things that certainly didn't exist in my parents' era. There are very, very active groups in Los Angeles around the environmental justice issue. And these groups are organizing not through kind of this class structure, but through grassroots community-building organizations. Even the churches, as well as soccer leagues. Mm-hmm. It's wherever people congregate in joint activities that represent kind of a shared identity.
So you're saying that social and civic action is coming out of people being together in soccer leagues?
Because it gives them an opportunity to talk about their neighborhood. It gives them an opportunity to say, hey, did you see that there's a new WIC office, or that the park has been cleaned up, or did you see that drug dealers have moved in down the road? You know, it gives them an opportunity to build neighborhood association, you know, to actually talk with each other about their neighborhood.
And that's what we're finding, is that the challenge for organizations and resources trying to reach communities that are notoriously hard to reach is that the ideas of how to reach people have to be flexible to include places and meeting and greeting, you know, spaces such as soccer leagues and things that people had never really considered doing. And yet we find that, you know, healthcare and other resources that actually go to the soccer leagues on a Saturday morning to hand out information about a new resource are getting people in the doors in a way that, you know, sending, you know, flyers all over our community doesn't hit the same level of effectiveness. So It's about thinking in new and flexible ways and realizing that every community, even if it's demographically similar to another community, is going to be a unique case, and that resources and information need to be provided in such a way that they connect with that particular community.
As you know, the LA Times is in pitch battle with its owner, the Chicago-based Tribune Company, and its circulation has been declining. As you've studied neighborhoods in Los Angeles, what have you learned about the newspaper's relevance to the lives of people there?
Well, there are an awful lot of people in Los Angeles whose primary newspaper is not the LA Times. It may be a Korean language paper, a Chinese language paper, an Armenian language paper, a Spanish language paper. But the LA Times, once it made the decision to try and compete on a national level with the New York Times and the Washington Post, and that one of the ways it could better compete was to allocate its resources away from the local Los Angeles communities, they lost relevance to a lot of people in Los Angeles. I mean, it's true for African Americans. It's true for people that even in South Pasadena, where you have a newspaper that's devoted to that area, that newspaper beats the LA Times in terms of people's allegiance because it talks about South Pasadena or about the local community. Part of the problem is that researchers like ourselves, up until this time, have not paid much attention to media other than the so-called mainstream media. And that's one of the lessons we've learned, is that there's a whole media world out there that is where a lot of the action is, especially when it comes to questions of community.
I think you've found that community or neighborhood or ethnic newspapers can have a big influence on how immigrants integrate into life in the U.S., and it has to do with the focus on the native country. Talk to me about that.
Well, one of the difficulties is that a lot of the largest, let's particularly like Korean language and Chinese Mandarin or Cantonese language papers and media are not owned by people here. They're owned, let's say, back in Taiwan or in Korea. They're multinational corporations. Those kinds of papers really do not see much of a mission other than keeping their diasporic, you know, populations connected to the home country. So they're not very invested in local news coverage. On the other hand, working with some of the papers we have here, they've begun to see that their long-term survival is in paying much more attention to the everyday lives, let's say, of Koreans living in Los Angeles than they had in the past. It's these media where a lot of the negotiation of what it means to be an American is going on these days. Can they be simultaneously Korean and American, or Mexican and American, or Armenian and American? It's not like the immigration era of the past, at least we don't think it is.
But will the Korean newspaper matter to the second generation Korean American?
Yes, it does, and to the third and fourth, because I think we are in a global era where it's not like, you know, the immigrants of the 20s and 30s, where the main thing that happened was to assimilate as fast as possible into the dominant culture. These days, it's a different kind of, some people call it hybrid identity, that you can be both Korean and American instead of a hyphenated American. Well, no one's really sure how this is going to play out, because it's very dynamic right now, because we are living in a world where to be Korean, let's say, to be able to know the Korean culture and to speak the language and all of that can be a real advantage in terms of your career. It can open up business possibilities for you that are not available to people who lose their language by the second or third generation.
And also the question of viability Without question, that means that these media are going to have to and have been having conversations and dialogues about content that they've never had before. And we see these kinds of compromises in, you know, certain newspapers and publications becoming bilingual, that there's content in Korean or Spanish or Chinese and in English. Or we see it in the actual subjects that they're covering in order to make themselves more relevant to a second generation or to an immigrant who settled much longer ago than many of our more recent arrivals. What we've found is that ethnic media cover sort of a dual role in a way that a mainstream newspaper does not. They can serve the dual role of orienting the immigrant or the second generation youth, and the reason that this is so much in flux is because the second generation youth who came parents that came after 1965 are only now beginning to grow up, so these questions can only really start to be asked now. But the first function that it can fulfill is to orient the immigrant or their children to the home country, to happenings that are going on there and other issues of cultural significance. And the second function is to orient the immigrant or their children to activities in their local areas. And it's this balancing act between home country and culture content and American localized content, that balancing act and how to negotiate that in different spaces and over time. That's going to be the question of viability in the second generation and in generations to follow it. And there's some newspapers and other media that have more success with that than others.
We have data to show that for people that are very attached to their, let's say, non-English language media, that by the second generation, their interest in getting local news about their residential community goes up, and it keeps going up into the fourth and fifth generation. However, their interest in home country news is also there. So from an argument of economic viability, a lot of these media are coming to see that they have to engage in both, keeping people in touch with the local community and with the home country. And I think the pattern that's going to emerge is not like it used to be, where people would drop, you know, the foreign language media by the time they were third generation. These days we see some indication that people are reading both. They're reading or connecting to mainstream as well as to ethnic media.
If you were the editor of the LA Times and you said, I want to recapture the local market, local market now being something very different than it was 50 years ago, say, what would you do?
Well, I do. Actually, we have an FCC hearing going on here today. It's very interesting, in which Warren Christopher and a bunch of people are testifying that they're terribly upset with the LA Times for not doing any classical media function, you know, telling the story of the community to build civic pride and civic participation. And so that very issue is being addressed today. What I would do is that I would say, I've got to learn how to adjust to this new media world. I have to not only be concerned about the fact that we are no longer a traditional newspaper. We have to be in both the internet kind of spaces and in paper spaces. We have to be both. And we've got to learn how to connect with the very, very diverse communities of Los Angeles in a way that we've not really ever done before. And the best way to do that is to talk to the people in those communities that really do represent those communities. You know, what are the most important community organizations in the everyday lives of those people? And get to know the heads of those community organizations, the people that are really on the ground, not just the people with, you know, an ability to get foundation funding and things, but the people who really love and know those communities and are committed to building them. talk to those people and make sure that you have a diverse enough staff that is able to identify when somebody really represents the interests and orientation of that community. And also, maybe you could engage high school students or engage journalism students. Right now, we're starting a course in which we're trying to get journalism students to pay more attention to neighborhood news and learn how to tell neighborhood stories that are that build connections with a readership. It's not just pretty stories or bad stories. It's ones that really build connections with a readership and would make them keep connected to you over time. What the LA Times has been doing is kind of, in my judgment, a little lazy and perhaps even cynical, and that is they'll cover one major figure that they know about in each of the ethnic communities, and they'll do it, it seems, kind of premeditatedly, as if, oh, well, we've done the Korean story, we've done the Japanese story, we've done, you know, the Latino story. And that just doesn't make it. That kind of storytelling is not creative. It's lazy and it's superficial.
Do you think, though, if the LA Times were covering the stories that you want them to cover, that you suggest they should tell to build readership and to build relevance, do they then run the risk of turning others off? In other words, is that story about the ethnic neighborhood person so obscure to me and so irrelevant to me in my life that that's then a turnoff? I mean, do you see a risk on that side?
Yeah, that's quite possible. That's quite possible. And the what they tried a few years back, and they stopped it in the, oh, by 2000, they completely stopped having these sections of the paper that were customized to the different areas of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Neighbor sections.
Yeah, uh-huh. And part of the problem was that it was poor journalism. If you're going to do a neighborhood section, which I think deals with part of the problem that you're talking about, then do it well.
Well, it was fun to talk to both of you about LA. I appreciate you being with us on Smart City.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Vicki Katz is a PhD student at the Annenberg School. Sandra Ball-Rokish is the director of the Communication Technology and Community Program there and director of the Metamorphosis Project. Much speculation has been made about the baby boomer generation and its impact on our country's economy. As CityView's commentator Walker Smith notes, this group will have an effect in areas you might not expect.
The fitness industry has a new rallying cry these days, age management, which is to say, helping baby boomers not get old. Why? Because that's where demand is going to come from in the future. Just as boomers fueled the aerobics boom of the 80s, think back to boomers John Travolta and Jamie Lee Curtis in the 1985 movie Perfect, so too will they drive a wellness and fitness boom in the future. According to American Sports Data, a sports research firm, from 1998 to 2004, the fastest growing group exercising at least 100 days per year was people 55 years of age and older. The 33% growth in this age group was far greater than the zero growth over the same period among people 18 to 34 years of age and the mere 13% growth among people 35 to 54 years of age. People 55 plus also account for roughly one quarter of all health club memberships sold each year. And this is where many of tomorrow's jobs will be found. The Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that fitness and health club jobs will increase 27% over the next decade, and health care and social assistance jobs by 30%. But there's a lot more to the business of age management than just selling health club memberships. The broader opportunity is about wellness, And that includes many business sectors such as nutritional supplements, nutraceuticals, personal trainers, nutrition specialists, dietitians, home exercise equipment, plastic surgery, yoga, strength training, Pilates, boxing, elliptical trainers, recumbent cycles, indoor cycling, gene repair, stress management, and more. Everything associated with age management is headed up because baby boomers are determined not to get old. Staying in the game is going to be a challenge for boomers in more ways than one, however. Perhaps the best measure of this enduring boomer interest in fitness is the new malady known as boomeritis, a term coined by an orthopedic surgeon to describe the sports-related injuries that are now the second most common reason behind the common cold that baby boomers visit a doctor. Boomeritis accounted for 488 million lost workdays in 2002. Baby boomer sports injuries were up 33% from the beginning to the end of the 90s, and that's only going to grow. Boomeritis isn't going to hold boomers back, though. Improved surgical procedures have made new knees and new hips easier and less risky to get. In fact, the demand is expected to be so great that the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons worries that there won't be enough qualified doctors to perform the operations. Based on the demographics of an aging yet active population, the scientific consulting firm Exponent projects a 673% increase in knee replacements by 2030, as well as a 174% increase in hip replacements and a 54% increase in partial joint replacements. Boomers are going to be breaking a sweat for a long time to come. Boomers aren't decelerating into old age. Forget that stereotype. Boomers are going to stay active, and thus well into their 70s, 80s, and beyond, they will continue to be the most powerful, influential, and active group in American society. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta. Thank you.